This morning is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts against BCS Insurance.
May it please the Court. I propose to address this morning the employer's insurance and Stolt-Nielsen issues, but of course if the Court has questions on the jurisdictional issues, I'm prepared to address those as well. Employer's Insurance of Wausau was a reasonable resolution in 2006 of the who decides question for consolidation of arbitrations, but it cannot be squared with the United States Supreme Court's decision in 2010 in Stolt-Nielsen.
I think you need to begin by discussing our jurisdiction. That's been contested, and that's obviously the first question on this appeal.
Your Honor, with regard to the jurisdictional issues, the main point is that we appealed a final order of this Court. All interlocutory orders are, therefore, on appeal.
No, that's not going to get you where you want to go. I understand that proposition, but your lead argument with respect to Judge Holderman's appointment of the third arbitrator is that the district judge lacked authority to appoint an arbitrator because we had exclusive authority. That depends on whether we had jurisdiction over your first appeal, the interlocutory appeal. So, no, you can't duck on that ground. Do we have jurisdiction on your interlocutory appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is that once we filed the interlocutory appeal under Bradford Scott, jurisdiction vested in this court, if the issues in the appeal and the remaining proceedings in the district court were interrelated. And if
I'm lost. We have no jurisdiction over interlocutory appeals unless some statute gives us jurisdiction. The only conceivable statute that would give us jurisdiction is Section 16. And Section 16A2 expressly forbids any appeal, any interlocutory appeal, of an order directing arbitration. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Arbitration was directed. It wasn't directed on the terms your client favored, but it was directed. It looks like 16A2 expressly forbids your appeal. And therefore, your appeal, notice of appeal, can't possibly have deprived the district court of jurisdiction.
Your Honor, my issue with...
perfectly straightforward?
My issue with that analysis is that the order was not an order directing arbitration to proceed. It was an order denying our Section 4 petition. Did it also have a ramification of allowing an arbitration to go forward? Yes, it did. But as Arthur Anderson versus Carlisle says, you have to look at the nature of the order appealed from. And after all, in that very case, a similar argument was made that, well, this was the estoppel argument that was presented by Arthur Anderson in that case expanded the scope of arbitration, so it shouldn't fall within the statute. But the Supreme Court said you have to read the statute to say what it says. It says what it says, and it says in that case that orders you can appeal under Section 16. You can appeal a Section 3 order, even though it's interlocutory, if it is a stay of arbitration. And by that same analysis, Your Honor, this order by Judge Lefkoe denied our Section 4 petition, and under the other subsection of Section 16, we should have appellate jurisdiction under Carlisle.
So your position is the district court did not order arbitration?
Yes, Your Honor. She wasn't asked to order arbitration, except by us. And she denied our petition to order arbitration.
Arbitration was the result of her ruling. Isn't that correct?
Well, one could argue, Your Honor, that arbitration was a result of their demand for arbitration, and that the arbitration that was demanded is going forward regardless of the court orders. What has been denied is our demand for arbitration under Section 6, under Section 4, and we're appealing the denial of our demand for arbitration, our motion to compel arbitration.
No, but I'd say the ultimate result of that was proceed with arbitration, right?
That's true. The ultimate result is an arbitration would proceed. But the fact is, we filed an appropriate Section 4 petition. Even if you disagree with the merits of our Section 4 petition, the fact is there's jurisdiction under Carlisle.
Well, the motion, which is technically the subject of this appeal, is as you say, but that's only technical. I think the policy of the statute is the other way, isn't it?
With all due respect, Your Honor, that was very similar to the argument that Carlisle made in the Arthur Anderson versus Carlisle case, and the court rejected that kind of an argument. You have to look to what the statute says in Section 16. Now,
counsel, I have a question on jurisdiction. Judge Lefkoe denied your motion to deconsolidate the arbitration. How can you transform that order into an order denying that arbitration proceed under Title IX, Section 16A1B? Aren't the two completely different concepts?
She denied our petition to compel an arbitration. And
16A2,
yeah,
expressly forbids your appeal. So are you trying to go under 16A1B?
A1B is the denial of a petition to compel arbitration, Section 4. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes, that's what we're appealing under. And the reason is that that's exactly what her order did. We sought to compel arbitration in accordance with the terms of the agreement. That's what Section 4 allows, and then she denied that. So under the express language of that subsection, Section 16, there should be appellate jurisdiction. Now, Employers Insurance applied the Supreme Court's decisions in First Options versus Kaplan and Howsam versus Dean Witter, and it read those cases, those two Supreme Court cases, to drop issues into essentially two buckets. First, there's the arbitrability bucket of First Options. All questions of arbitrability are for courts. And the other is the procedural bucket announced by Howsam, where all procedural issues are for arbitrators. Stolt-Nielsen has now taken that Howsam procedural bucket and divided it into two. Arbitrators no longer have the power to decide all procedural issues under Howsam. Specifically, they have no power to decide whether to order an arbitration procedure when the parties did not explicitly agree to that procedure, and when the procedure would materially change the nature of the arbitration to which the parties did agree. Who has the power to decide a procedural issue, and whether the arbitration panel exceeded its powers when it decided that issue in a particular way, are two sides of the same coin. Both depend completely on what the parties in their agreement empowered the arbitrators to do. Power, after all, is power. If an award can be vacated at the back end of an arbitration because the arbitrators had no power to implement a procedure, then the arbitrators had no power at the front end of the arbitration.
I don't understand that. I mean, that's an absolutely absurd argument. It's an argument that whatever grounds can be asserted for upsetting an arbitration must therefore necessarily be resolved before the arbitration begins. That would just destroy the entire practice of arbitration. Everything would be litigated ex ante, and then it would be arbitrated.
Your Honor,
you can't be serious.
We're serious, Your Honor. The procedural bucket in the middle from Howsam, it's the biggest bucket by far. The vast majority of all issues will be resolved by arbitrators, majority of all arbitration issues. These two other buckets are at the extremes.
It is true, counsel, that the vast majority of issues will be resolved by arbitrators. But the ability of lawyers to make arguments that arbitrators shouldn't resolve one or another issue seems to me, at least, to be unlimited. We see quite a few cases of the sort you're describing. And if we said, it's open season, any argument you lawyers can make can be presented to the district court, and then they'll be presented on appeal before the arbitration can even get going. The idea of arbitration as a cheap and quick substitute for litigation would be gone, because you'd have litigation and appeal, then arbitration, then litigation, and then appeal. It would be a disaster. That seems to be what you're arguing.
We're only talking about, frankly, a narrow set of issues at the outer extremes. It's only when there is a material change from what the parties agreed.
I'm terribly sorry, counsel. You say, well, it's a narrow issue because in this case we're right. But the argument you're making can't be limited to arguments in which the lawyer is right. The lawyer makes an argument and the district court would have to resolve it, and then there would be an interlocutory appeal.
Your Honor, there must be...
You cannot have a legal system that says the only argument that can be made to a district court is an argument that's right.
You also cannot have an argument presented to an arbitrator unless the parties agreed to submit it to the arbitrator. And someone has to decide whether there's an agreement to arbitrate an issue. The Supreme Court, after all, in that case, in Stolt-Nielsen itself, the arbitrators decided an issue. And under the standard of review rules, the decision of the arbitrator should be respected, because after all, if the parties agree that the arbitrators have to decide an issue, then it's entitled to respect and it's hands off to the courts. But the Supreme Court still threw out the decision, and it was a procedural decision. The Supreme Court threw out a procedural decision of the arbitrators, and the reason was the decision was not grounded in the agreement of the parties. So yes, you don't want to open the floodgates to the courts. However, as I say, there has to be limits. On the one hand, there is an arbitrability limit under first options. Questions of arbitrability are for the courts, and even if it's a bunch of clever lawyers coming up with clever non-arbitrability arguments, there is a limit where courts have to step in. And all Stolt-Nielsen did was present a limit at the other end. Even if it's a procedural issue where the arbitrators have taken a position, you still need an outer boundary. What if, for example, Your Honor, what if an arbitration got going and an arbitrator says, okay, from now on all proceedings are going to be in Bulgarian. You know, you all better go get your translators because this is going to go on in Bulgarian. Now, there's a pretty good argument that that is so far removed from the agreement of the parties that the courts have to step in and stop that. Now,
the decision discuss or purport to modify Hausen or overrule it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What effect did the decision have on Hausen?
Did Stolt-Nielsen have on Hausen?
Yeah.
It modified the holding of Hausen, or it limited it, because Hausen essentially said all procedural.
Well, they didn't purport to do that, I don't believe.
They addressed Hausen in one paragraph, and in the very next paragraph said, the rule of Hausen doesn't control this case. And it's because, even though it's a procedural issue, class was a procedural issue, this was such a procedure that so materially changed the nature of the arbitration that we aren't going to follow the rule of Hausen. Although they didn't cite Hausen in that second paragraph, that's essentially what they did. And I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Tessier.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Tessier, and I represent five of the appellees in this case: Blue Cross of Idaho, Care First, Health Now New York, Blue Cross of Louisiana, and Mountain State Blue Cross and Blue Shield. My co-counsel, Joanne Lytle, represents Blue Cross of Massachusetts, and she will also be addressing the court as well this morning. Addressing the jurisdictional argument first, because I think that's where the court's analysis should begin, I think the court hit the nail right on the head. The issue is, does the statute provide a basis for BCS's interlocutory appeal? And it doesn't. BCS's argument, essentially boils down to we called our cross petition a petition to compel arbitration. Therefore, we fit within Section 16A1B, which says if you deny a petition to compel arbitration, then that interlocutory order is appealable. However, the statute expressly states that in Section 16B2 that interlocutory appeals that direct arbitration to proceed are not appealable. And that's exactly what happened here. The district court said no. The issue of whether or not an arbitration clause allows for consolidation is a procedural issue, and I'm directing the arbitration to proceed where the parties can address that argument within the context of the arbitration. So I think you really have to look at the substance of the judge's order. It's not the label of the petition that BCS can name however it wants, but the question is, what is the nature of the order? And the effect of that order was to allow arbitration to proceed. I think the court also pointed to a key issue about...
You're arguing the policy of the statute against the technical point of what was the order that was actually appealed, right?
Your Honor, I would say that we're arguing about the scheme of Section 16, but also the specific wording. Our argument is that under Section 16B2, if the order directs arbitration to proceed, that is not appealable on an interlocutory basis.
Did the district judge enter an order directing arbitration to proceed?
Yes. Absolutely.
And which order was it in particular?
It would be the June 6th order, Your Honor. That Judge Lefkoe's
The only June 6th order that's in the appendix to the brief says BCI Insurance Company's cross petition to compel arbitration is denied. So what order compelled arbitration?
It's the order that directed arbitration to proceed, and that's what...
What order directed arbitration to proceed?
That order, Your Honor.
No, it didn't. This order says cross petition to compel arbitration is denied. There's no order directing arbitration to proceed.
I think you have to look at what the order says, and the order...
I did. It said cross petition to compel arbitration is denied. We have some trouble with the word denied?
No, Your Honor, I have no trouble with the court's order, but what the court ordered was for arbitration to proceed.
What the court said, the order says petition to compel arbitration is denied. Now, if there's some other order compelling arbitration, that's fine. If what you want instead to say is that the consequence of this order is that an already pending arbitration will proceed, that's fine, too. You can make the argument that instead of relying on the language of the order, we should rely on something else. But you can't argue, at least not with a straight face, and at least not if you want to be helpful to the court, that an order denying arbitration is actually an order compelling arbitration, and we have only to put on polarized glasses to see things backward.
Well, Your Honor, I think the one fact that would be helpful is that BCS did not file an arbitration demand. What BCS was attempting to do was to stop an existing ongoing arbitration in its tracks by asking for a court order that said the arbitration cannot proceed on a consolidated basis. And so I think that the court should look not only at the order, the effect of the order, and also the statutory scheme. And I think if you consider all of those things, that BCS's interlocutory appeal was improper. The issue in this case is who decides? Who decides whether an arbitration clause allows consolidated arbitration? BCS has conceded in this case that there is, in fact, an opinion by this court that is directly on point and that requires the result in the district court, that consolidation is an issue that must be decided by the arbitrators. And, in fact, the Seventh Circuit's decision in Employers Insurance is not in isolation on this issue. It's not alone. In fact, as we pointed out in the briefs, several other circuits, including the First Circuit in Shaw's, supermarkets, the Third Circuit and certain underwriters, and even the U.S. Supreme Court in Housam talk about how procedural issues are presumptively for the arbitrators to decide. The entire premise of BCS's appeal in this case is that Stolt-Nielsen the U.S. Supreme Court's decision regarding class arbitration overruled employers' insurance. And Stolt-Nielsen, if you look at the decision, expressly states that it is not addressing the issue of who decides. It was addressing the merits of the arbitrator's decision on whether or not class arbitration was allowable in that particular case. In fact, the parties in Stolt-Nielsen stipulated that the arbitrators should decide the issue first, and they did. And the procedural context in which Stolt-Nielsen addressed this issue was on review under Section 10A4 of the Federal Arbitration Act. Did the arbitrators exceed their powers? So if BCS's position is true, and that the Supreme Court in Stolt-Nielsen said it's completely inappropriate for the arbitrators to decide this issue because it so fundamentally changes the nature of arbitration, then they would have said that. They would have said that, no, that was improper.
No, they wouldn't have said that. The Supreme Court addresses questions that are presented in petitions for certiorari. As far as I can figure out, this question was not presented in the petition for certiorari. So no matter what they thought about that issue, they wouldn't have said anything about it, and there wouldn't have been a holding about it. It doesn't make any sense to argue there was some implicit holding from what they did or didn't discuss when they didn't grant certiorari on a question. It seems to me important to understand how the Supreme Court comes to decide things.
I understand your point, Your Honor, and in fact, I think that demonstrates why BCS loses in this case, because BCS's position is that somehow this issue was addressed by the Supreme Court.
It's certainly wrong to think that Stolt-Nielsen required us to depart from circuit authority, Century Indemnity. On the other hand, we are entitled to overrule Century Indemnity if we are now persuaded it's wrong. We're not compelled by Stolt-Nielsen to do it, but we can think about whether it's right or wrong.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Housem that these issues are presumptively for the arbitrators to decide provides the court some guidance. In fact, that was a decision which I believe was not limited or overruled in part by the U.S. Supreme Court in Stolt-Nielsen. And I think the basis for this court's decision in employers' insurance remains strong and should be reaffirmed in this case. The problem for BCS in this case is that they are mixing apples and oranges. They are confusing the issue of who decides with the ultimate result, that is, whether or not an arbitration panel exceeds its authority, exceeds its powers by ordering arbitration. And here's the key fact. In Stolt-Nielsen, there was a stipulation by the parties that said that there was no agreement on class action arbitration, and that was a critical piece of the Supreme Court's decision in Stolt-Nielsen that in this particular case that the arbitration panel did not have the authority to order class action arbitration. So that issue is a separate and distinct issue of who decides. Now, BCS wants to compare the issue of class action arbitration, which was at issue in Stolt-Nielsen, with the issue of consolidated arbitration. And in Stolt-Nielsen, the U.S. Supreme Court said that class action arbitration is a game changer. It is so fundamentally different from the nature of bilateral arbitration that when you have a stipulation by the parties that there is no agreement, and the best that the party seeking class action arbitration can say is, well, we agreed to arbitrate, the Supreme Court said that's not enough. Now, in this particular case, a consolidated arbitration does not present any of the concerns or issues that the Supreme Court was addressing in Stolt-Nielsen. For example, one of the issues why the court considered class action arbitration to be a game changer is because the number of the parties was dramatically different. The court said that it could involve hundreds or even thousands of parties. Well, in this case, we don't have a game changer. We have six insureds and one consolidated arbitration. And, in fact, if you look at the case law, I think the Anwar case is a good example where the court ruled that a consolidated arbitration with 38 parties does not fundamentally change the nature of the arbitration. The second concern that the court had in Stolt-Nielsen was this issue of privacy. The class action arbitration in Stolt-Nielsen would have been governed by the AAA rules for class action, which explicitly reject privacy and confidentiality issues by virtue of the fact that it's a class action that would potentially bind absent parties. This case, there are no considerations like that. The consolidated arbitration is not governed by the AAA rules that the court found so troublesome in Stolt-Nielsen, and there's no reason why the arbitration cannot be confidential and private in this particular case. The court in Stolt-Nielsen was also concerned about absent parties. The court was saying it was such a game changer to have not only the parties that were the class action representative be bound by this, but also the hundreds and thousands of other potential parties. And we don't have that issue in our case as well. There are six Blue Cross plans that are seeking coverage under the policy issued by BCS. All of them are represented and participating in this arbitration. The final concern was whether or not the commercial stakes are dramatically higher. And I have to point out that BCS has not presented any evidence in this case regarding the commercial stakes that are at issue or why they're so much higher than in a bilateral arbitration. In fact, BCS never identifies what the threshold is. At what point does the dollar amount have to be larger in order for the court to determine this is a game changer? It's so dramatically different that you have to have an express agreement by the parties to allow for consolidated arbitration. The fact remains that whether you arbitrate six times separately or in one consolidated arbitration, that the commercial stakes are the same. Thank you.
Ms. Little.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Joanne Lytle, and I am counsel for Appalachian Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. We join in co-counsel's arguments, and there are just a very few points I'd like to address briefly. In response to Judge Pratt's question, what BCS called a petition to compel arbitration was, in fact, a motion for deconsolidation. Now, Judge Lefkow's order denied the petition as it was presented, and she called it a cross-petition to compel arbitration. But the order also says, for further details, see below. And the judge went on to say,
I hate to tell you, but it is a rule that judgments cannot incorporate other language.
And I won't address that point, Your Honor.
That's a pretty straightforward rule. It's clear this order does not comply with the rules of civil procedure, and in particular Rule 58, but no, C statement below has no legal effect at all.
I will not address that point, Your Honor. With respect to form over substance, as to whether this was a petition to compel or a motion to deconsolidate, BCS never demanded arbitration. When they received an arbitration demand, they appointed one arbitrator, not six. And when Judge Holderman pressed for a ruling and an opinion on who was the least objectionable of the plan's candidates, BCS put forth one arbitrator candidate and said, consider this guy as chair of the panel. It was very clear that BCS did not, in fact, file a cross petition, regardless of whatever words they typed on the top of the document. With respect to whether this court should overrule employers' insurance, the Supreme Court's decision in Howsam still applies here. Procedural questions that grow out of the dispute and bear on the final disposition are presumptively for the arbitrators. What courts address are questions of arbitrability. Those have been defined as two things. Is there a binding agreement that binds these parties, and does that agreement cover the type of dispute here? This is not a question of arbitrability. This is a procedural matter, and Howsam is certainly good law on that point. And under this court's still valid ruling in employers' insurance, the burden is now on BCS to show that the agreement requires the court to decide the question of consolidation, and BCS has not met that burden. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Lytle. Anything further, Mr. Wilson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. This is a who decides case. Only issues that the parties agreed to arbitrate can go to arbitrators. So the question is presented, where is the agreement that BCS entered to arbitrate this consolidation issue? Where is it? It's not in those policies. There's nothing explicit in any of the policies.
Now it sounds like you're just disagreeing with Howsam. All of the procedural issues that are covered by Howsam are not separately provided for in an arbitration agreement.
Correct. It's not it's this
I'm
issue
glad,
only.
I'm glad you think I'm correct.
It's only when
it's
there's
so,
an.
It's so good of you.
I meant no disrespect, Your Honor. This issue always arises when there is a question of an implicit agreement. So now we're presented with the question, well, where's the implicit agreement?
No, it doesn't depend on implicit agreements.
Well, there has to be some agreement.
Read Howsam.
I have. My point is simply that arbitration is a matter of consent, not coercion, and if we never agreed to arbitrate this issue, we're being coerced into doing so. And look at the differences. This is what counsel...
Hey, you're just disagreeing with Howsam.
Your Honor, the lead argument in Stolt-Nielsen to the Supreme Court was that the parties stipulated that an arbitrator should decide this issue, and so it is entitled to respect, hands off to the courts, because it's an arbitration procedural issue. And the Supreme Court stepped in, and the Supreme Court is a court, after all, and threw out the arbitrator decision. The courts stepped in and took in a procedural issue away from the arbitrators in Stolt-Nielsen. That surely has some ramifications for the scope of the Howsam all procedural issues are for arbitrators rule. It cannot be said that now, after Stolt-Nielsen, all procedural issues, no matter what, are still for arbitrators. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.